When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 7, Part 1 of Garibaldi and the Making of Italy by George Macaulay Trevelyan. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The March Through Calabria. Oh, how comely it is, and how reviving, to the spirits of just men long oppressed, when God into the hands of their deliverer puts invincible might, to quell the mighty of the earth, the oppressor, the brute and boisterous force of violent men, hardy and industrious to support, tyrannic power but raging to pursue, the righteous and all such as honor truth. He all their ammunition and feats of war defeats, with plain heroic magnitude of mind, the celestial vigor armed, their armories and magazines contemns, renders them useless, while with winged expedition, swift as the lightning glance, he executes his errand on the wicked, who, surprised, lose their defense, distracted and amazed. Milton. The Calabrian liberals were not altogether unworthy of such a deliverer. The Garibaldini, who had seen little to admire in the inhabitants of eastern Sicily, in spite of all the facile enthusiasm at Messina, declared that when they had crossed the straits they soon found themselves among a staid, manly, and athletic population. Travellers who today visit those remote but magnificent regions notice with relief that the corruption of Naples has not infected the whole south of the peninsula. The Calabrians of those days were not unaccustomed to war. For 60 years past, they had from time to time conducted guerrilla campaigns for and against the Bourbons. Some towns had always been on the side of reaction, like Pizzo, whose fishermen had arrested Murat along with their nets on the beach and handed him over to his death, while others, like Monteleone, on the hill above, had no less constantly been liberal. In the period of those French and English wars, the prevailing sentiment in Calabria had been reactionary, or at least anti-French. But since Waterloo, 40 years of obscurantist inquisition into every household by spies and police officers, had left the restored Bourbons but few zealous adherents, and had made every man of spirit and in intelligence their active enemy. In 1848 the Calabrian peasants had upheld the national cause with a valor that distinguished them among the populations of southern Italy. In the reaction that followed, the leaders of the movement, doctors, professors, and landed proprietors, had gone into prison and into exile. Their day was now come. Francesco Stocco of the Thousand, the principal landlord of the Catanzaro district, reappeared among his own people with a wound which he had received at Calatafimi, yet unhealed. In 1860, feudal devotion was still strong in Calabria, and helped much to make the rising effective. Even in exile, Stocco had been regarded as the real leader of the country, like a Highland chief living across the water after 1745. And now he was among his people once more. They answered to his call, as to that of a tribal king who interpreted the will of Garibaldi, the racial deity. Unfortunately, Stocco was a simple and disinterested man and used his authority well. On August 26th, the citizens of Catanzaro proclaimed the dictator's government, while the town was still occupied by the Bourbon garrison. When it marched out next day towards Nicastro, It was surrounded and disarmed by the people of that region 2 days before the arrival of the Garibaldian vanguard. Meanwhile, the mountain shepherds of Aspromonte and the farmers of the fruit-bearing hills that overlook the fever-stricken plains of Maida gathered to a head under Francesco Stocco. They pitched their camp several thousand strong on the plateau of Campo Lungo above the bridge of Angitola and prepared there to cut off the retreat of Vial and his 12,000 men. Vial still laid at Monteleone, while Stocco thus blocked his road to the north, and Garibaldi advanced upon him from the south. Pianell had at length ordered him to retreat on the capital, but the only path left open was by sea, and he had only one steamer lying off Pizzo. He used it to effect his own escape to Naples, taking on board with him 1,000 of his men. The rest he bequeathed to General Gio, with instructions that they should march back by land. 1,000 more disbanded, leaving Gio with 10,000, the last royalists in Lower Calabria. From the semaphore station on the heights of Monteleone, the grass-grown site of an ancient Greek city, Gio could watch through his telescope the bivouac of Stocco's Calabrians on the tableland of Campo Lungo, close above the high road by which alone he could hope to retreat. Seeing himself thus cut off, he sent a flag of truce to the dictator and begged for a free passage to Naples with the honors of war. On August 26th, Gio's messenger found Garibaldi at Nicotera, a town perched on the sea cliff some miles off the great trunk road along which the armies were moving. The dictator had made his way thither with two or three companions alone, in order to superintend the disembarkation of Medici's troops from Messina. Taking a short cut from Gioja, he and his friends had left their horses and walked 7 miles through deep sand and marshes of the plain, wading through rivers above the knee. He thus arrived in time to welcome Medici's men as they landed on the beach below Nicotera. Thence he sent back Gio's officer to Monteleone with a demand for the unconditional surrender of the 10,000. At dawn on the 27th, the dictator posted over the hills to Monteleone by way of Mileto, where he rejoined the vanguard of his army coming up from Rosarno by the great trunk road. Mileto, situated halfway up the long rise out of the plain to the heights of Monteleone, was famed for the numbers of its clergy and its brigands. The wealthy bishop had fled, but the priests and people welcomed Garibaldi and his men. In the middle of the main street was to be seen a dried pool of blood and the charred remains of some large animal. On that spot, 2 days before, the Bourbon troops had detected their general Briganti attempting to ride through Mileto in civilian disguise. It was he who had so recently surrendered at Villa San Giovanni. They fell upon him with cries of "Trattatore!" and emptied their rifles into his body, which they stripped and mutilated in beastly fashion, while others killed and burned his horse. All this took place in the open street of Mileto, beneath the eyes of the regimental officers, who drank shame to the dregs, looking on at the murder with pale cheeks and ineffectual murmurs of remonstrance. Some of the soldiers boasted that they had killed a general because he was a liberal and a traitor, others because he was a royalist, others because they wanted his boots. Horrified but encouraged by this evidence of the utter demoralization of his enemies, Garibaldi, after a siesta in a garden at Mileto, drove on to Monteleone the same day, hoping to receive the surrender of these wretched men. On the afternoon of the 27th, his carriage mounted to the edge of the green and prosperous tableland of Monteleone, whence the moral and material squalor of the towns down below seems to have been banished by decree of nature, ever since the ancient Greeks founded their city of Hipponium upon this pleasant sward. The Garibaldini, like other travelers before and since, were enchanted by the panorama of the Mediterranean, Stromboli, Sicily, and nearer at hand the long outline of Aspromonte, by the city with its hospitable inhabitants, its free and cheerful life, its unexpected treasure of sanctuary and architecture. Garibaldi himself, first to arrive, was given a welcome that is remembered in Monteleone as the greatest event in its civic life. For 60 years its inhabitants had been true to the cause of freedom, and for more than 40 of those years had been subject to cruel oppression. For weeks past their town had been the enemy's headquarters. The day before they had narrowly escaped massacre at the hands of the soldiery who had murdered Briganti, and they had been saved only by the wisdom and energy of the Marquis Gagliardi, the patriot leader of the town. But now Garibaldi was among them, standing in a balcony with arms crossed and head bowed, looking long and in silence at the crowd below. Unworded things and old seemed passing between him and them by some mysterious sympathy of race. At length he spoke. "When a people replies as you have done to the call of freedom, then freedom is its due. The destinies of Italy are secure, and no power on earth can alter them." But it was the silence and not the words that dwelt most in the memory of some present. There was, however, one cause for disappointment. Gio's 10,000, who had marched out of the town shortly before Garibaldi's arrival, were allowed by Stocco to march past him unchallenged. It appears that Sertori had sent Stocco a message which he intercepted to mean that the Neapolitan troops had joined the national cause and were to be treated as brothers in arms. They were therefore allowed to file across the long bridge of Angitola and below the wooded precipice of Campo Lungo, under the eyes of Stocco's army, who stood at ease and cheered them as they passed. But Gio's men were, in fact, still bearing arms against Garibaldi, and he had declared for nothing short of their unconditional surrender. The mistake, whether due to Sertori or to Stocco, called for instant remedy. If Gio's men recovered their morale or fell in with Caldarelli's troops in Upper Calabria, they might yet occupy one of the 1,000-strong mountain positions that barred the road to Naples and seriously delay the dictator's advance. In any case, he did not want 10,000 more added to the royalist troops collecting for the defense of the capital. He therefore left Monteleone on the 28th at a hand gallop to ride down the fugitive army. He was partly accompanied and partly pursued by the mounted portion of his staff and by some English ladies and gentlemen in a carriage. There were as yet no cavalry, so the rest of his men, with Stocco's bands well to the fore, were to come on behind as fast as their legs would carry them. The country through which the race now ran, with its ever-changing views of mountain, plain, and sea, was rich in memories of the last 60 years of feud between revolution and reaction. First, they left behind them Pizzo, hanging on a cliff over the beach, with its squalid little castle where Murat had been shot, an eagle trapped in a filthy cage and torn to pieces by vermin. At the bridge of La Grazia, they passed a battlefield of 48. Then the road wound among low, fruit-laden hills, skirting the Campagna of Maida. On that seaward plain, half covered with brushwood, and cut by sandy streams and white fiumari, the British infantry, set ashore by our fleet in July 1806, had, in half an hour of volley firing, proved the superiority of the line formation over the French column, which had carried all before it since the Revolutionary Wars began. The grand mountains, looking down on the battlefield from north and east, had been the scene of the Calabrian rising against the French that followed on the British victory, when the methods of the reactionary bands so horrified our officers that many of them were glad to be driven back to Sicily, and swore never again to let loose such devilry on the mainland. Following up the valley of the Amato, Garibaldi turned into the heart of these mountains, where far other political sentiments now prevailed among the peasants, and under his influence, those blood feuds of Bourbon and Jacobin, those marchings of foreign armies on the soil, belonged to an era that was passing away, as the flag of Italy and Victor Emmanuel brought the hope of an ordered freedom. Garibaldi and the best mounted officers in his staff were acting militarily as their own scouts, politically as their own heralds. The first comers of all their army, they were enthusiastically welcomed by the peasants, who saw with special delight that the dictator was wearing the conical hat of Calabria. He and his friends had no baggage and no change of clothes. Each had one travel-stained red shirt, which was sometimes washed at the midday siesta and put on again to dry as they rode forward under the scorching sun. In this guise, the small group of horsemen climbed up the steep ascent out of the Amato Valley to the ancient town of Tiriolo that hangs on the edge of the mountain wall 2,000 feet above the Tyrrhenian and Ionian seas. Besides this simultaneous view of the two parts of the Mediterranean, the riders admired the gorgeous Calabrian costumes of the women, which then, as now, were seen at their best in the neighborhood of Tiriolo. Thence the trunk road runs northwards for a 2 days' journey to Cosenza, at an average height of over 2,000 feet, through an endless succession of oak and chestnut forests, above the flanks of deep, wooded gorges, down which, even in August and September, the clear water went leaping and gurgling to the sea. In these altitudes Garibaldi overtook Ghio's army. On the evening of August 29th, 5 miles beyond Tiriolo, he suddenly came in sight of the tail of the enemy's column winding round the flank of the mountain a few hundred yards in front. Since he had only a half a dozen companions with him, he turned aside for the night into the neighboring village of San Pietro, after sending to bid Stocco's Calabrians to come up with all possible speed. While the staff was at supper, an earthquake shook the village, and all rushed out into the street, except only Garibaldi, who remained seated as if he had felt nothing. At dawn he started again to seize his prey. While the rising sun flooded the peaks and valleys with light, he followed the road along the crest of a wooded ridge, which opened out after 6 miles into the high cultivated tableland of Soveria. At the farther end of this plateau, close beneath still higher mountains to the north, lay the village of Soveria Manelli. In its long street and on the flat cornland round, Garibaldi bivouacked the whole of Ghio's army of 10,000 men, packed like sheep in a fold, without rear guard or advanced guard, without sentinels placed or outposts occupying the surrounding heights. The men were disconsolately cooking some stolen lambs. The officers were doing nothing. There was no sign that they intended to proceed with their march. Ghio had in fact abandoned the idea of further retreat, because he had learned that the pass of Agrifoglio, 5 miles up to the north, was blocked against him by the men of Upper Calabria. These bands from Cosenza and Castrovillari, led by their feudal chiefs Pace and Morelli, had already on August 27th compelled 3,000 troops under General Caldarelli at Cosenza to enter upon an agreement to retreat with arms in their hands to Naples. The rebels had next proceeded to occupy Agrifoglio Pass, fearing that if Ghio crossed the watershed and marched down into the district of Cosenza with 10,000 fresh troops from the south, Caldarelli would throw over his agreement and unite with the newcomers to strike another blow for the royal cause. On the summit of this forest pass, more than 3,000 feet above the sea, were encamped the Calabrian mountaineers in their theatrical costume, armed with shotguns, axes, pikes, and scythes. Among them, superintending the defenses of the pass, rode the white-haired Altamari, with the medal of Santa Helena and the cross of the Legion of Honor upon his breast. He had known colder work than these August days and nights among the oak woods, for he had marched to Moscow and back. He had been one of the 500,000 combatants in the Armageddon on the plains of Leipzig. He had led his fellow Calabrians in 1820 and in 1848, and now his eyes were to see the coming of Garibaldi. Under his direction, trenches were dug and trees felled across the road, up which Ghio would have to march. But Ghio was being informed that Caldarelli had come to terms and that the summit of Agrifoglio Pass was thus fortified against his own retreat. determined to proceed no farther, but supinely to await the arrival of Garibaldi at Soveria. There, throughout the morning of August 30th, band after band of Stocco's Calabrians came in from Turiglio and the south, exhausted with their forced march but eager to be led into action. As fast as each arrived on the plateau, Garibaldi led them up to San Tommaso village and the other hills to east and north of Soveria. Down below, the Bourbon troops still sat cooking their lambs, watching Garibaldi's encircling movement with the fixed indifference of despair. In the course of the morning, Mario Paird and the ex-priest Bianchi from the camp at Agrifoglio severally entered the village and demanded the surrender of Gio's army. They were received with courtesy by the general and by some of the troops, while others were with difficulty restrained from shooting them. Soon after midday, Garibaldi found himself at the head of 2,000 of Stocco's Calabrians and a few of Cosenz's red shirts ranged in a circle round the village below. He gave the word to advance, and the Garibaldini silently and slowly moved down upon Gio's 10,000, as they had done upon Briganti's smaller force at Villa San Giovanni a week before. There was no resistance and no formal capitulation. It was understood that the men were free to go each his own way, and that the officers were to be supplied with journey money. They spontaneously gave up their 10,000 rifles and 12 cannon, and without more ado disbanded, each to his own home or to a life of brigandage. Several thousand of the rifles were distributed among the Calabrian bands of Stocco, Pace, and Morelli, many of whom, thus armed, came on to Naples and took part in the Volturno campaign. The captured horses enabled Garibaldi for the first time since he had crossed the straits to mount 100 cavalry. Hitherto his Hungarian hussars had trudged all the way, trailing their large spurs and sabres through the dust. But when the enemy's horses were made over to them at Soveria, the gallant gentlemen sprang into the saddles with a clarity of a cavalier race reared on the Magyar plains to horsemanship and war. They seemed to the onlookers to be suddenly transfigured from tired tramps into knights of old romance, galloping off joyfully into the forest in search of dragons and giants and some glorious way to die. In the midst of these scenes of confusion and triumph in the squalid street of Soveria, a messenger arrived from Naples and handed a letter to Garibaldi. It was from Alexander Dumas, who had recently gone to the capital in his yacht. He wrote that he had obtained an interview with Liborio Romano, now the principal minister of the king and by far the most influential person in Naples. Liborio, wrote Dumas, is at your disposition together with at least two of his fellow ministers at the first attempt at reaction on the king's part. At this first attempt, which will set him free from his oath of fidelity, Liborio Romano offers to leave Naples with two of his colleagues, to present himself to you, to proclaim the disposition of the king and to recognize you as dictator. Garibaldi sped the messenger back to Naples to tell Liborio that the Neapolitans ought to be prepared to rise at any moment in case it should prove necessary, but that they were, if possible, to postpone the decisive event until he himself was at the gates. He set out to follow the messenger as fast as horses could carry him, again leaving his army days behind upon the road. Two fears drew him on to the capital at his topmost speed. The fear that anarchy, massacre, or civil war would break out before his arrival, and the fear that Cavour and Victor Emmanuel would seize the reins of power in Naples, and so bring to an end his dictatorship, and with it his chance of invading the Papal States. Meanwhile, the other detachments of his army, scattered along the road between Scilla and Tiriolo, were toiling after the vanguard by forced marches. It was the hottest period of the year, cooled by occasional thunderstorms. There was no proper commissariat, and the food of the country was scarce, especially for the rear guard who followed where Gio's 10,000 and their own main body had already swept the villages clean. Fruit was in season, and in some places on the route abundant. But few of Garibaldi's followers could, like their leader, be satisfied with a bunch of grapes, a cigar, and the thought of Italy as a substitute for a day's rations. Everything was paid for at a good price, and grape thieves were liable to be shot. Once at least the corpse of a red shirt laid out between the vineyards and the road warned the passing columns that the general's discipline was still as severe as his hour of triumph, as it had been 11 years before during the disastrous retreat from Rome. "When I remember the plundering propensities of my own countrymen," wrote an English gentleman who had beheld this wayside portent, "I shudder to think what may be the consequences should many join the army." His fears were well grounded, for 2 months later, 5 members of the British Legion were condemned to be shot for plundering on the north bank of the Volturno, where they had been left on the usual Garibaldian short rations, an intolerable torture to the hungrier Saxon race. But their sentence was commuted for imprisonment. End of Chapter 7, Part 1. Chapter 7, Part 2 of Garibaldi and the Making of Italy by George Macaulay Trevelyan. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Miseries of the Forced March. The liberated populations were enthusiastic in their welcome, and profuse of all the hospitality which they had to offer. But in those days the material resources of civilization in Calabria and Basilicata were of the most meagre kind. Hunger, exposure, and the ceaseless forced march made the race to Naples one of the severest physical tests of patriotic endurance. It took away from the mother of the Carioli another of her boys, Luigi, who died of typhus contracted on the road, and many stronger men were left behind disabled. Both French and English, who shared in the march, admired the endurance and self-restraint of the Italian volunteers. The dictator, at first on horseback, later in an open carriage, was forging on ahead with a few companions. 5 miles above Soveria, on the top of the watershed of Agrifoglio, which divides upper from lower Calabria, he was greeted with wild delight by the Calabrians, who had blocked the pass there against Gio's army. Thence he galloped along the well-engineered road which leads down the side of a forest gorge of alpine proportions to Carpezzano and Rogliano, and thence he pushed on again in the afternoon to Cosenza. The capital of Upper Calabria is built on the steep sides of 3 separate hills, above the meeting place of 2 mountain torrents, in one of which the Busento, Alaric the Goth, lies buried. At nightfall on the last evening of August, Garibaldi was welcomed into the streets of the city lit up in his honor. There were memories at Cosenza. Here, 16 years before, one of Italy's forlorn hopes had perished. The attack of a handful of idealists led by Ricciotti and the brothers Bandiera against the Bourbons in the plenitude of their power had here come to its tragic, premeditated end in order to teach the Italians by example a lesson which many had since learnt, how to die for their country. Garibaldi well remembered how the news had reached his penurious household in Montevideo, and how Anita and he had named their second-born after Ricciotti. The most sacred place in Cosenza was a nameless slab in an aisle of the cathedral under which the bodies lay. The victors of 1860 all went to do it honor. Garibaldi himself had not time to visit the other scene, 4 miles distant in the mountains, where the execution of the Bandieras had taken place. But after he had passed on his way, when, some days later, the main body of his followers began to arrive at Cosenza, nothing could restrain them from marching out, regiment after regiment, to see the water-washed stones in the torrent bed below Rovito, where their forerunners had dropped one by one before the firing party, with the forbidden name of Italy upon their lips. There the regiment stood bareheaded, while Nino Bixio addressed his men in words of fire. During the short night that Garibaldi spent at Cosenza, he made important military dispositions, in consequence of the arrival of Bertani, who had come up thither from Paola on the coast. Bertani announced that he had brought to Paola by sea 1,500 men of that large and well-equipped force which he had organized to invade the Papal States, but which Cavour and Garibaldi had between them diverted to Sicily and the south. When the dictator learnt that from Bertani that 1,500 men lay ready to his hand at Paola, with transports at their disposal, he sent Tuor down the coast to take over the command and carry them forward by sea from Paola to Sapri. In this way, a force that Bertani had raised in the interest of the advanced Mazzinian party passed under the control of Tuor, the most Cavourian of Garibaldi's lieutenants. Bertani, concealing his chagrin, attached himself to the person of the dictator, and began, after they had travelled together for a few days, to recover the influence which he seemed recently to have lost. Meanwhile, Tuor rode down from Cosenza to Paola, took command of the troops collected there, and carried them by sea to Sapri, where they arrived on September 2nd, 24 hours before Garibaldi himself. In this way, these 1,500 men from the rear became the vanguard of the advance on Naples, owing to their good fortune in finding transports while the others had to march by land. At 3 in the morning of September 1st, Garibaldi with Cosenz and Bertani left Cosenza in an open carriage, pursued and gradually overtaken by a second carriage containing paired with an English party. All morning their wheels ploughed through 20 miles of sandy high road along the desolate banks of the upper Crati. On each side of the mountains shut in the long valley bottom, a flat surface 2 miles broad, over which the muddy and rapid river spreads itself uncorrected in 100 irregular channels, hidden from the eye by dense brushwood, trees, and reeds of the marsh. This Macchia, as the watery jungle is called, unreclaimed by man since the beginning of time, seems fantastically out of place as the sole occupant of a broad and well-watered valley that looks, when first seen from distant hills, to be another Valdarno or Upper Tiber. But the sandy soil has deterred Greek, Roman, and modern Italian alike from introducing civilization or agriculture into the upper valley of the Crati. Even the hills around were thinly inhabited and notorious for brigands. At length, at noon, the trunk road led the travellers up out of this gigantic ditch onto the heights of Tarsia, and thence to Spezzano, Albanese, where the Albanian colonists, like their kinsmen of Piana de Grici near Palermo, greeted the dictator even more warmly, if that were possible, than the Italian villages along the road. From the hill of Spezzano, Garibaldi and his army, when it followed during the next week, gazed over the plain of Sybaris, bounded on three sides by peaked mountains, and on the fourth by the Gulf of Taranto. The view resembles that of the Campania from Tivoli, save that there is no Rome. Like Anio and Tiber, the lower reaches of the ancient Carathis and its tributaries still wander through the vast plain to the sea, but there is no city, no civilization, and no history save the knowledge that somewhere in that comfortless expanse, now breeding death at night, stood once Sybaris, mother of luxury. The site is unknown. Sybaris had disappeared as completely as Sodom and Gomorrah, though not by any catastrophe of nature. Only her name is left as a proverb of degeneracy, but whether the Sybarites deserve such eternal censure, more than their neighbors who destroyed them, and the civilizations that have succeeded them, remains a secret guarded forever in the memory of that silent plain. From Spezzano, Garibaldi descended into the western corner of the plain of Sybaris, and crossed it on a causeway through a marsh, out of which grew forest trees, swarming with birds like an English park. Thence he mounted to Castrovillari, one of the pleasantest towns south of Rome, a rival in importance to Cosenza, and a great center of revolution that year under the leadership of Pace. Castrovillari stands in the midst of a fruitful plateau, raised halfway between the plain of Sybaris below and the limestone peaks of Monte Pollino, which tower above to a height of 7,000 feet. The old town with its medieval churches and palaces is built in pleasing disorder around the edge of some precipitous canyons, which here cleave to the plateau. But already in 1860 the old town was falling into disrepair in favor of the more cheerful modern streets, long, straight, and spacious, in which stood Pace's house, the center of the insurrection, and on this night the headquarters of Garibaldi. The next morning, September 2nd, he passed on across the luxuriant plain that lies close at the foot of Monte Pollino, rivaling Tuscany in wealth of vegetation, and thence passed at once into the regions of naked limestone, the heart of the mountains which divide Calabria from Basilicata. At the top of the first pass he entered the Campo Tenese, a meadow 3,000 feet above the sea, and several miles in extent, closed on all sides by mountains. Here in a snowstorm in 1806 the French had put the army of the Bourbons to rout. At the far end of the Campo Tenese, Garibaldi climbed another pass, and thence descended out of Calabria into the Basilicata. The first place which he reached in the new province was the hill town of Rotonda, where he found the National Guard and all the paraphernalia of revolutionary authority already in being, as if it had been Paris or Cosenza at the least. At Rotonda a change took place in Garibaldi's method of travelling. Hitherto he had kept to the great trunk road the whole way from the Straits of Messina, but now, close in front of him on that road, were General Caldarelli's troops, retreating on Naples with arms in their hands according to the agreement which they had made with the Revolutionary Committee of Cosenza. If he proceeded farther, he would find himself at Castelluccio, in the midst of these demoralized royalist troops. Their intentions were doubtful, perhaps even to themselves. At one moment Caldarelli sent a message to Garibaldi at Rotonda saying, "This army of yours puts itself at your orders." At the next he was promising his soldiers the victory of the Bourbon cause through the intervention of Austria. The dictator's friends wisely persuaded him not to trust himself defenseless among these men, who might shoot him as readily as one of their own generals, but to go round by the mountains and the sea to Sapri, where he would find Torres' 1,500 men, newly come from Paola. With them he could march up to Lago Negro, present himself there in force upon the line of Caldarelli's retreat, and negotiate with him under more favorable conditions. So on the night of September 2nd, the general and six companions, including Bertani and Cosenz, left the high road at Rotonda, and, mounted on mules, rode towards the coast through the western mountains. Near Laino they entered the trackless gorge of the Lao River, and followed it down by the light of the moon for several miles.
"Here we are," cried Bertani, "seven of us on seven mules going to conquer a kingdom."
Out of the Lao Valley they climbed once more to the highest part of the mountains, and on the morning of September 3rd struck the coast at some point not far from Torata or Maratea. Thence a small boat took them on to Sapri. There's no finer part in the whole coastline of Italy than this unvisited Riviera, where the precipitous ridges run out one beyond another and sink into the waves. The rugged coast is best seen from a boat, but Garibaldi, exhausted by the night's ride, lay asleep in the prow, while his friends covered him with a sail to protect him from the rays of the noonday sun. Only as they entered the Bay of Sapri, they all stood up to gaze on the beauty of the scene, and to honor the memory of Pisani, who, in 1857, had run into this bay to raise the Italian flag upon the mountains. On the beach where his forerunner had landed under the shadow of doom, Garibaldi stepped ashore on the full tide of victory, welcomed as Fratello Garibaldi by the people of Sapri, who 3 years before had frowned on Pisani and his more questionable following. Here also the dictator found Tours' troops, who had sailed in the day before from Paola. There is a fine beach, but no artificial landing place at Sapri. Only there may be seen in the clear water the ruins of an ancient pier. It runs out from the foundation of a palace built long ago by some magnate of imperial Rome, who discovered the beauty of the little bay, and carried thither the whole apparatus of ancient luxury, leaving less adventurous pleasure-seekers at Puteoli and Baia. Some modern Lucullus will imitate him ere long. Meanwhile, Garibaldi landed there and spent the night in a straw hut upon the beach. The next day the dictator and Tours 1,500 men, mostly Milanese, marched up all morning from Sapri by precipitous forest paths to a shoulder of Monte Cucuzzo, and thence descended on the Lagonegro high road along which Caldarelli and his men were retreating. The road here runs at an average level of over 2,000 feet. The point where Garibaldi dropped down on it from the west was the wayside tavern of Il Fortino. Here, on September 4th, he was overtaken by Piola, an officer of the Piedmontese navy, whom Depretis, his pro-dictator in Sicily, had sent on commission to persuade him to permit the immediate annexation of the island to the dominions of Victor Emmanuel, Tours, and Cosenz, the soldiers in attendance on the general, eagerly seconded Piola, begging their chief to allow Sicily to be annexed on the condition that Depretis should for the present continue to govern it as Victor Emmanuel's lieutenant, and that supplies of men and money should continue to be sent from Sicily to the Garibaldian camp. Garibaldi yielded to their entreaties, and had actually dictated to his secretary the words, "Dear Depretis, have an annexation made wherever you like." When Bertani came in upon them from the other compartment of the tavern and caught his Cavourian rivals in the act, "General," said the agitator, "you are abdicating." And in spite of all that Tours and Cosenz could say, Bertani in a few minutes persuaded him to rely on the further liberation of Italy, not on the cooperation of Cavour and the Piedmontese government, but on the men and money which, so Bertani declared, would be supplied in unlimited quantities by Sicily and by the provinces of Naples as fast as they were liberated. The half-written letter was torn up and another was sent, bidding Depretis delay the annexation yet a while. Bertani's triumph at this unlucky pothouse of Il Fortino opened the way for the struggle between Garibaldi and the government of Turin, which during the ensuing months marred with unseemly altercation the solemn act of the making of Italy. Depretis was right. The time had come to annex Sicily, if Garibaldi could but have seen it. When in June he had refused to allow annexation, because it would have prevented him from crossing the straits, he had been right and Cavour wrong. But in September he could have no object in further delaying the annexation, except to keep himself free to attack the cities of Rome and Venice, or otherwise to thwart and embroil the policy of Victor Emmanuel's ministers. It is possible that if at Il Fortino he had known that Cavour was on the point of invading the Papal territories himself, he might have rejected Bertani's advice and consented to work hand in hand with the Piedmontese government. Meanwhile, the military business in hand was to catch Caldarelli and his 3,000. On September 3rd, before leaving Lagonegro, Caldarelli had again assured Garibaldi's emissaries that he and all his men intended to desert on the side of the nation. He had, however, continued his retreat on Naples, and had passed through Il Fortino a few hours before Garibaldi struck into the road at that point. On September 5th, he was finally overtaken near Padula, where Pisani had 3 years before been defeated by the royalist troops under Gio. There, Caldarelli's column nominally came over to the Garibaldian army, but the transaction was really a disbandment rather than a desertion. Indeed, some of the troops retained enough loyalty to attempt the murder of their general for having betrayed the cause, but the Garibaldini saved him out of their hands. At Castelnuovo, on September 5th, Garibaldi was met by Mignona, governor in his name of the province of Basilicata, which had declared for him more than a fortnight before, while he was engaged in crossing the straits. The Lucanians, as the men of the Basilicata called themselves in memory of classical times, sent through Mignona a goodwill offering of 6,000 ducats, and raised a Lucanian brigade, which followed Garibaldi to Naples. Thence 900 returned home, but the remaining 1,200 took part in the Volturno campaign. From Castel Nuovo the dictator raced in an open carriage through the province of Principato Sitiore. As he drew nearer to the capital, its corrupting influence became ever more apparent in the moral degradation of the people, and warlike volunteers were no longer forthcoming. But south of Naples there were no signs of reactionary feeling. All along the road the people and the local authorities vied with each other in the frenzy of their enthusiasm, which was compounded of joy at deliverance from a cruel and inquisitorial tyranny, interested subservience to the rulers of the hour, and good human devotion, in which also superstition had a part, for the person of the almost mythical Garibaldi. For several days, however, these semi-divine honors were paid to the wrong person. Paired, Garibaldi's Englishman, as he posted along the road from Sala Consilina to Eboli, was universally taken for the liberator himself. He was accompanied during this strange adventure by Galenga, one of the Times correspondents, by Commander C.S. Forbes of the British Navy, and by Fabrizi, who was commissioned by the dictator to survey the military positions in advance. These men, having the capacity of non-combatants, passed through Caldarelli's column prior to its disbandment, and kept the high road the whole way from Cosenza, and thus gained 50 miles on Garibaldi, who had been forced to go round by the coast. In the afternoon of September 3rd, while the dictator was sailing into the Bay of Sapri, Paird was entering Auletta amid a scene of tremendous enthusiasm. "The people," he noted in his diary, "thought I was Garibaldi, and it was thought that it would do good to yield to the delusion. It became a nuisance, for deputations arrived from all the neighborhood to kiss my excellency's hand, and I had to hold regular levees. The town was illuminated and Te Deum sung in honor of his arrival. Next day, while the real Garibaldi was weaving and unweaving the web of his uncertain policy in the tavern at Il Fortino, Paird and Fabrizi, accompanied by National Guard, brass bands, and the people of Auletta, ascended to the hamlet of Postiglione, where they found every one mad with excitement. At the syndic's, one of the priests went on his knees," writes Paird, "and called me a second Jesus Christ. I was not prepared for so excessive a bit of blasphemy." Postiglione hangs on the side of Monte Alburno, commanding a view of the plain of Eboli, with the gulf and mountains of Salerno beyond. Somewhere in that plain, or in those mountains, as Fabrizi and Paird well knew, Francis II must fight for Naples, or else abandon his capital without a blow. 12,000 of his soldiers lay in Salerno, and on the pass of Cava behind it. The plain of Eboli in front, patrolled by his squadrons, had for several days past been considered as the ground where the regular army, strong in cavalry and artillery, would have the best chance of defeating the Garibaldini. There were, at the lowest computation, 40,000 infantry and 4,000 cavalry ready to hand in Naples and its environs. The dictator had with him only Tudor's 1,500 men, recently landed at Sapri, but if he could afford to wait for a fortnight, which was extremely doubtful, he might hope to collect his full force of some 20,000 infantry and 100 cavalry. Even on these terms, a royalist victory was not to be won in the plains of Eboli. The steep wall of mountains behind Salerno would still form a natural barrier, protecting the approaches to Naples. Paird and Fabrizi determined to take advantage of their strange situation to spread such reports as would strike panic into the enemy's headquarters and lead to the abandonment of these all-important positions. In pursuance of this design, they hastened on to Eboli. On the evening of September 4th, at some risk of being caught there by the enemy's patrols or arrested by the local authorities, who had not yet come within the sphere of the advancing revolution. But the pseudo-Garibaldi brought the revolution with him wherever he appeared.
Within a half an hour of our arrival, wrote Commander Forbes, Eboli was brilliantly illuminated, the entire population besieging the syndic's brass bands banging away in every direction, and the crowd roaring, themselves hoarse and calling on the general to appear, reminding one more of an election than anything else, the National Guard being all this time severely engaged on the staircase in a vain endeavor to keep the inhabitants out of the house. Deputations arrived. First came the church, headed by a bishop. Forbes at one moment tried to persuade some of the leading men that Peard was not Garibaldi. "Oh, you're quite right to try and keep your secret," they replied. "But you know it won't do. We know." The gigantic Englishman did not, in fact, resemble the Nizzard at all closely, but his greater height and longer beard in no way impaired the belief of the people that they had the hero among them. Peard and his Italian companions of the jest decided to turn the absurd situation to serious account. Shortly before midnight they sent for the official in charge of the telegraph, who appeared trembling before the dictator, between a file of the National Guard. He reported that the Neapolitan general commanding at Salerno had an hour before wired for information about Caldarelli's brigade and Garibaldi's movements. Peard dictated the reply, announcing Garibaldi's presence at Eboli, and exaggerating to 4,000 or 5,000 the number of troops that he had close at hand. Above all, he announced that Caldarelli's brigade had changed sides and was now marching with the national forces. All these statements were inaccurate, but they appear to have been believed both at Salerno and in the capital. Galenga, who was with Peard, wired the same reports to private friends in Naples, closely connected with the court and ministry. The belief, erroneous in fact, that Caldarelli's men had gone over of their own accord to the invaders, led everyone to expect that the troops at Salerno would do the same, unless they were withdrawn before Garibaldi could reach them from Eboli. Thus the misleading reports circulated by Peard and Galenga, and the presence of the supposed Garibaldi at so short a distance from Salerno, were among the influences which induced Francis II not to fight for his capital. This decision was taken beyond recall on the morning of September 5th, when the commander-in-chief at Naples telegraphed to Marshal Afan de Rivera at Salerno, ordering all the troops at Salerno to retreat by way of Cava to Nocera. Meanwhile, the pseudo-Garibaldi and his party, not knowing that their bluff would succeed in scaring the enemy away, escaped unnoticed from Eboli in the small hours of the morning. Peard returned as far as Sala Coselina to meet the real Garibaldi, who hardly approved what he had done. When they heard that the royalists had evacuated their positions, Peard hastened forward again at Garibaldi's request, and entered Salerno in triumph at 5 in the morning of September 6th. The whole town turned out to welcome the dictator, who received deputations in public all morning, detected by no one in authority or out of it, except by a single officer who whispered him in the air. In the course of the morning the Piedmontese vessel, Othion, appeared off Salerno, and set ashore Evelyn Ashley, son of good Lord Shaftesbury, and private secretary to Lord Palmerston. The young man, to the intense delight of his chief, had gone out to spend his holidays with Garibaldi, instead of with the Partridges. A few days before, Ashley had presented himself to Cavour in Turin, with a letter of introduction from the British Prime Minister, who had asked where he could find Garibaldi. "Garibaldi, who is he?" said Cavour, with a twinkle in his eye. "I have nothing to do with him. He is somewhere in the kingdom of the Two Sicilies, I believe, but that is not, you know, at present under my king." However, Cavour put Ashley on board the Othion and sent him to search for himself. He took with him Mr. Edwin James, Q.C., and at Naples fell in with others of his fellow countrymen, with whom he continued to coast southwards. Off Salerno they saw flags and heard the shouting of a vast multitude in the town. On being informed that it betokened the arrival of Garibaldi, the Englishmen landed, only to find that it was in reality Peard.
by this time exceedingly anxious to be relieved from his task of impersonation. He asked his compatriots to go and meet Garibaldi and hasten his coming. On the road the English party met hundreds of disbanded royalist troops, unarmed, starving, and in the last state of misery, dragging themselves home along the road, or lying prostrate by the wayside. Garibaldi had shared with them all the money he had at hand, but their condition was pitiable. Arrived in Eboli, Ashley found the dictator, who greeted him warmly as England's emissary, and allowed him to follow his staff as a non-combatant, on the sole condition that the newcomer should wear his simple livery in order to be safe from maltreatment in the confusion of the times. And so our Premier's secretary donned the red shirt. At 5 in the evening of September 6th, the dictator and his staff entered Salerno in a string of open carriages, 2 days' march in front of his nearest troops, the 1,500, under Tour, and many days in front of the rest of the army. Outside the town he was met by the syndic, the National Guard, and his English precursor, now deposed. "Viva Garibaldi!" he cried, taking off his hat in mock homage to Peard, and everyone joined in the cry with shouts of laughter and applause. Darkness fell as they forced their way one step at a time into Salerno, amid the delirium of 20,000 people, who seemed desirous to tear the real Garibaldi in pieces. The town was illuminated, and all the heights far away towards Amalfi and Sorrento were ablaze with fires of joy. On the same evening, the last of the Bourbons and his queen were leaving the Palace of Naples by the Watergate and taking ship for Gaeta. End of Chapter 7, Part 2. Chapter 8 of Garibaldi and the Making of Italy by George Macaulay Trevelyan. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Entry into Naples. Venu e Gelubardo, venu e lo più bel. Neapolitan Song of 1860. The flight of King Francis from Naples on September 6th was but the final catastrophe in a process of dissolution which had set in with the news of the fall of Palermo and the consequent proclamation of constitutional rights in June. Freedom of the press and person had effectively and instantly broken up the machinery of repression. The police had, in Liborio Romano's conjuring hands, been turned in a few days into an instrument of liberalism. The king had handed over the civil administration to his enemies, and had gained nothing in return except the diplomatic support of France that failed him at every crisis. At home, the Constitution won over to him a few individuals, but no class or party. The decadent nobility of the capital, the peasants of certain districts in the northern provinces, and the bulk of the army remained loyal, not because of the Constitution, but in spite of it. Everyone else was looking to Piedmont. The perfidy of his ancestors divided King Francis from his people. Remembering the fate of the constitutions of 1820 and 1848, the citizens refused to enroll themselves on the electoral lists because, in case of redaction, the appearance of their names on the register might be used against them as evidence of treason. And when Garibaldi in August came marching up through the constituencies, all talk of holding elections for Parliament ceased. The king suspected his ministers, though most of them were passively loyal. Above all, and with good reason, he hated Don Liborio Romano. But Don Liborio, like Lafayette in the autumn of 1789, was the man of the hour, with whom neither court nor people could dispense. He had at his beck and call the police, the National Guard of respectable burghers, and the Camorra of criminals. So King Francis had to endure him throughout all July and August, first as police minister only, and then as Minister of the Interior also. In the latter half of August, Don Liborio held confidential interviews on the subject of coming events with the dictator's friends in Naples, with the Piedmontese Admiral Persano, and with the king's uncle, the Count of Syracuse, who had already openly declared for a change of dynasty. Persano wrote to Cavour that Don Liborio was helping the cause of national unity so far as he was permitted by his very delicate situation as minister of Francis II. His object, however, was not actively to compass the destruction of his master, which he regarded as already certain, but to prevent the fall of the dynasty from involving in its ruin the public peace and safety. For this reason, as well as for the satisfaction of his own vanity, he had accepted office in June, and for this reason he determined to remain in power during the days or hours that must elapse between the fall of Francis II and the establishment of any new form of government. If he forced the king to accept his resignation, the Camorra would, he believed, break loose in the great city, which contained a larger proportion of criminally disposed persons than any other in Europe. The royal troops would begin to fight with the National Guard, and disasters of the most appalling character might occur. The respectable part of the citizens took the same view, begging Don Liborio and his colleagues to retain office under the crown at any sacrifice to their own dignity or honor. And those who knew best the Naples of those days were the least inclined to deny the claim afterwards put forward by the discredited politician that he saved the capital from destruction. Meanwhile, the Cavourian agents were striving in vain to precipitate a revolution. Villamarina, the Piedmontese minister at Naples, and Admiral Persano, who arrived there with his fleet from Sicily at the beginning of August, lent their aid to Finzi and Visconti Venosta, to Nisco d'Ayala and Nunziante in their attempts to win over the army and incite the civilians to resolute action. But the army remained loyal, in spite of the propaganda of the popular general Nunziante among his old companions in arms, and in spite of the blandishments of Piedmontese Bersaglieri. Some companies of the latter were allowed to land off Persano's ships and to show themselves in the streets, partly in order to encourage the population to revolt and partly in order to fraternize with the Neapolitan troops, who replied by breaking their heads. The citizens were more sympathetic, but not more active than the soldiers. The Neapolitans did not see the use of doing, at the risk of their own skins, what Garibaldi was coming to do for them. Moreover, the Mancinian Committee of Action, which contained the bolder and more energetic spirits, had resolved to wait for the dictator's arrival, fearing that if they rose before he appeared on the scene, Naples would fall at once into the hands of Cavour, while the Cavourian Committee of Order, which would fain have seen a revolution effected while Garibaldi was still on his way, consisted of moderate men, unfitted by nature to initiate a revolt. The motives of Cavour's policy throughout August are relatively clear to those who will read them in the light of two established facts. First, that he had, in the last days of July, persuaded Russell to permit Garibaldi's passage of the Straits, and secondly, that he had, as early as August 1st, made up his mind to invade the Papal provinces with the Piedmontese army. His desire was, without more delay, to possess himself of Naples and to forestall a Garibaldian dictatorship, while at the same time he would invade the Papal states and so link up the north and south of the peninsula in one free monarchy. It was not only because he feared that the revolution in Naples would perhaps misfire without the help of the guerrilla that he had persuaded Russell to let him cross from Sicily to the mainland. Even after he had taken this step as a measure of insurance in case of his own failure, he continued to work for the overthrow of Francis II through his own agents, and since time was needed for this experiment, he was not sorry to see the dictator kept waiting 3 weeks at the Straits. That is the same reason why, in the days of August, he wrote to Admiral Persano, "Do not help the passage of General Garibaldi onto the continent, but rather try to delay him by indirect means as far as possible." When the dictator had safely crossed and was beginning his march through Calabria, Cavour caused arms to be landed at Salerno and distributed among the rebels of the south, in order to open the way for Garibaldi's advance. But at the same time he made a last effort to obtain possession of Naples for his own party, writing to Villa Marina on August 27th, "Do all you can to avoid a Garibaldian dictatorship on which you count too much." He instructed Persano to accept the dictatorship if it was offered to him. Even now, Cavour shrank from the one sure method of avoiding the Garibaldian regime in Naples, which he so much dreaded, namely an open declaration of war by Piedmont on King Francis, because, as he told Villa Marina, that would compromise us altogether with Europe. By Europe, he meant most of all Napoleon, with whom he was at that moment secretly negotiating for leave to attack the Papal territory. A few days later he saw that he had lost the race for Naples. On August 30th, while the dictator was receiving the surrender of Gio's 10,000 at Soveria, Cavour wrote to Villa Marina acknowledging defeat and bidding him abandon all thought of forming a government at Naples independent of Garibaldi. "You must act frankly in unison with him, trying only to get the fleet and the forts into our hands." Although Cavour failed actually to overturn Francis II before the arrival of Garibaldi, the prestige of the royal family and of the royalist party was rapidly melting away throughout the whole of August. The National Guard, the police, the citizens and the Piedmontese agents were all in a tacit conspiracy against the king and his soldiers, and whenever any of the latter gave vent to their feelings by rioting in the streets, their bad discipline was pointed to as proof that Francis II intended to destroy the constitution by military force. A series of half-hearted reactionary plots were unearthed by Don Liborio's police, and their details published to the further discomfiture of the king. In one of these conspiracies, his uncle, the Count of Aquila, was supposed to be implicated. Aquila had been for weeks an ardent constitutionalist, but he had rejoined the ultraist royalists in the hope, it was said, of displacing his incompetent nephew in their affections. On August 14th, the ministers succeeded in driving him into exile under cover of sending him on a foreign mission. On August 20th, Don Liborio presented to the king his famous memorandum, in which he tried to persuade his master to retire from the kingdom for some time, leaving as regent a minister who would inspire police confidence. "In this way alone," wrote Don Liborio, "could the horrors of civil war be averted, seeing that mutual confidence between the people and their prince has become not only difficult but impossible." 4 days after Francis had received this broad hint from his principal minister of state, he was made the target of a public letter from his uncle of Syracuse, in which the count exhorted his nephew to sacrifice his throne on behalf of the glorious idea of Italian unity. Such language from a prince of the blood produced a very general impression that all was now lost. Syracuse had shown the letter to Persano in his flagship 5 days before it appeared. The ever-shifting intentions and intrigues of the king and his many rival counselors during the last fortnight of Bourbon rule in Naples are known to us at present chiefly through the narratives of Liborio Romano and of General Pianell and his wife. These represent the constitutional party alone, and even so are inconsistent with each other on several important points. Unless other documents come to light, the historian will never be able to trace confidently and in detail the story of those days of cowardice, treachery, confusion, and panic. Only the outline of events is clear. It was agreed by all parties in the palace that the presence of the king himself in the field was necessary if the demoralized troops were ever to face Garibaldi again. It was also common ground that the capital should be spared and should not, like Palermo, be made the scene of conflict. The main division of opinion between constitutionalists and reactionaries arose on the question whether the king should go south to defend the capital in the plains of Eboli and the mountains of Salerno, or whether he should abandon Naples and retire north with all the loyal troops in the kingdom behind the line of the Volturno. In the latter case, he could base his new position on the strongly fortified towns of Capua and Gaeta, which might prove for him what the Quadrilateral had been to Austria in 1848, a rock of refuge on which the rebels would vainly waste their strength until the time was ripe for a royalist counterattack and a triumphal return to the capital. Against Garibaldi, who had no siege guns and no siege science, the plan had a fair likelihood of success, as subsequent events showed. It was the political as well as a military move, for the retreat northwards would mean the abandonment of the tricolour in favour of the old white flag of the Bourbons, and bearing of the Constitution and a frank return to reaction on the Bomba model. The removal of the soldiers from the capital northwards would enable them to indulge their loyalist sentiments freely in a more favourable atmosphere. Don Liborio and his colleagues would remain in Naples, while the Queen Dowager and her reactionary clique were already at Gaeta, waiting for the king. The reactionary peasants of the Volturno district were already threatening the lives of the local liberals. The papal border and the papal army were close in the rear of Gaeta. It may therefore be supposed that the advice to retreat behind the Volturno originated from the king's secret advisers of the ultra-royalist party. As early as August 27th, his constitutional ministers found that he was meditating such a retreat, but his purposes wavered from day to day and from hour to hour, and the only sound of the approaching footsteps of Garibaldi could bring him to the point of a resolve. On August 29th, his ministers, for their part, urged him to go south and head the troops at Salerno in defense of the capital and the Constitution, though it is difficult to suppose that they wished him a complete victory. On the same day, the reactionaries, headed by Count Trapani, another of the king's uncles, were hatching a plot to arrest the ministers. The loyalist proclamation, which was to have been published as the watchword of this coup d'etat, was seized overnight by Don Liborio's police and produced at the council board by the indignant men against whom it had been aimed. King Francis, red with mingled anger and embarrassment, gasped out that he agreed with much in the proclamation, and gave his ministers to understand that he was to some extent in the confidence of the conspirators, who had plotted their arrest. The ministry, who had already attempted to resign, now pressed with somewhat greater earnestness for leave to be quit of the royal service. But even now the king refused to part with them, on the ground that he could find no one else willing to form a cabinet, and when their friends of the National Guard warned them that anarchy would break loose in the streets as soon as their resignation became known, they consented, all except Pianell, to continue a while longer in office. Affairs remained in this suspended condition until the night of September 4th, when Peard's telegrams, the supposed presence of Garibaldi at Eboli, and the reported desertion of Caldarelli's troops brought the king's irresolution to an end and gave him the requisite energy to carry out his plan of retreat to Gaeta. Accordingly, on September 5th, Francis II announced his approaching departure to the ministers, the mayor, and the officers of the National Guard, to whom he committed the charge of keeping order in the capital during his absence. He spoke without bitterness, of which there seems to have been singularly little in his mild and foolish nature. He excused himself for going. "But your Joe, I mean our Joe, is at the gates," he said to these men, whom he well knew to be preparing in their hearts an enthusiastic reception for Garibaldi. On the same day he and his brave Bavarian queen went for their last drive in the streets of Naples. They sat in an open carriage, like simple private citizens, and the passers-by, who took off their hats to them in silence, observed that they were laughing and talking together as usual. The clumsy shyness of the king's demeanor to his wife, which had stressed her in the early months of their marriage, had now to a large extent passed away. A few yards from the palace, at the busy entrance of the Chiaia, their equipage was brought to a stand by a block in the traffic, and they were forced to wait some moments close to a gang of workmen who were taking down the Bourbon lilies from over the shop front of the chemist to the royal family. Francis pointed out to Maria Sophia the too significant nature of the men's task, and husband and wife turned to each other and laughed, Next morning, September 6th, the walls of Naples were placarded with the king's proclamation of farewell to his people. In restrained and dignified language, he protested against the way in which he was being driven from his capital, in spite of his constitutional concessions, and announced that he hoped to return if the luck of war and politics favored his claims. In the course of the day, the main part of the army marched out of the town by the Capua Road, indignantly refusing De Alva's invitation to fraternize with the National Guard and desert to the side of Italy. A garrison of 6,000 or 10,000 was left behind to guard the fortress of the capital, but their commanding officers were strictly ordered by Francis II to remain neutral and to shed no blood. Nothing was said to them about surrender or evacuation, although if they were attacked, they would only hold the forts by shedding blood, which would transgress both the letter and the spirit of the king's commands. It is probable that he had not clearly thought out what he wished them to do, but it may fairly be said that he adhered to an honorable manner to his decision not to inflict the horrors of war on Naples, and the rumor that he ordered the castles to bombard the town after he had gone was pure fiction. At 4 in the afternoon, the constitutional ministers were summoned to the palace to take their leave of the king. There was no party in the state that wished them to accompany him to Gaeta. They found him courteous and cheerful, buoyed up by excitement at great change and by relief after long tension. He said to Don Liborio, half in jest, half in earnest, "Don Libo, look out for your head," referring no doubt to his own prospective return. "Sire," was the unabashed reply, "I will do my best to keep it on my shoulders." The ministers were not invited to say farewell to the Queen. Shortly before 6 in the evening, Francis and Maria Sophia walked down arm in arm from the palace to the dock which lay close under their windows. Both were composed and cheerful. The Queen left her wardrobe behind, saying to her maids, "We shall come back again." The hundreds of Neapolitan grandees and officials, who had fattened on the court for 20 years past, were notable by their absence. But the faithful Captain Cristulo received his sovereigns on board the Messaggero, a small ship of 160 horsepower and 4 guns. As she steamed through the crowded port of Naples, she ran up a signal for the rest of the fleet to follow, but not one vessel stirred. The captains were already in league with Persano, and the prevailing sentiment of the men, and still more of the officers, favored united Italy. The little ship, shunned by all her fellows, carried the last of the Bourbons forever out of sight of Vesuvius and the bay. At dusk, she passed the island of Nisida, where Gladstone had visited Bomba's victims. A few minutes later, off Procida, she met another section of the fleet, signaled again, and was again disobeyed. All night she ploughed her solitary way under the stars, through a tranquil sea. In the interregnum of 20 hours that followed, the king's departure was outwardly the quietest, but inwardly the most anxious day that Naples had passed for several weeks. Knowing that the Bourbon garrisons were still in the 4 great castles, Nuovo, San Elmo, Del Ovo, and Carmine, the population stayed indoors until something decisive occurred. Fortunately, the authorities took the right steps. Liborio Romano still continued to act and to sign himself as Minister of Police and the Interior, though under which king seemed uncertain. His continued presence at the head of affairs helped to preserve public confidence and peace. He sent at once for the mayor, Prince d'Alessandria, and for de Sauge, the general of the National Guard, and agreed with them that Garibaldi must enter Naples as soon as fitting preparations had been made for his reception, and as soon as he had troops enough at his side to ensure his safety against the Bourbon garrison. Within an hour of the king's departure, 2 officers of the National Guard were sent off to Salerno on what was then the only railroad south of the capital. It ran along the coast past Vesuvius, turned inland by Pompeii, and ended at Vietri, 2 miles outside Salerno. On their way, the two officers met a number of Bavarian mercenaries retreating northwards from the abandoned positions of Salerno and Cava. At Salerno, which they reached by 10 at night, they found the streets lighted up, and groups of people stirred cheering disturbedly. Garibaldi had made his entry and had gone to rest. The envoys reported to Cosenz the flight of the king and announced the intention of the mayor and the commander of the National Guard to come from Naples early next morning. Garibaldi, when he awoke on September 7th, telegraphed to Don Liborio, "As soon as the mayor and commanding officer of the National Guard arrive from Naples, I will come to you. I am waiting for them first." Don Liborio wired back, "To the invincible General Garibaldi, dictator of the Two Sicilies, Liborio Romano, Minister of the Interior and Police. Naples awaits your arrival with the greatest impatience to salute you as the redeemer of Italy, and to place in your hands the power of state and her own destinies. I await your further orders and am, with unlimited respect for you, invincible dictator, Liborio Romano." This exchange of telegrams barely preceded the arrival at Salerno of the mayor and general, who were at once ushered into the presence of Garibaldi. He was surprised to hear from them that Naples did not expect him that day, and expressed annoyance at the suggestion of any need to erect triumphal arches and to make official preparations for his entry. The more serious arguments for delay were the presence of the Bavarians on the railway line between Salerno and the capital, the garrisons in the four castles with cannon trained on the heart of the city, and the absence of Garibaldi's own army. His nearest force, Tours 1500, were still 48 hours behind, and the rest of his 20,000 men were scattered along the roads of Basilicata and Calabria at distances varying from 4 to 14 days' march. His staff officers, Bertani, and the emissaries from Naples all besought him to wait at least till Tours' force came up, until the departure of the Bavarians for Capua was completed. But Garibaldi, hearing some talk of difficulties and dangers in the capital, swept all this aside. "Naples is in danger," he said, rising to put an end to the conference. "We must go there today. We must go this minute." His friends were horror-struck, but they knew better than to resist. His decision was approved by the event, and indeed hesitation on his part might have dispelled the illusion of his invincible power and compromised his peaceful occupation of the city. And thus he was able to enter as he wished, not like a conqueror surrounded by an army, but as a deliverer welcomed and protected by the people. After dispatching a telegram to the capital announcing their arrival for midday, the dictator and his party drove out of Salerno at exactly 9:30 in the morning of Friday, the 7th of September, amid another scene of frantic enthusiasm. At the terminus station of Vietri, they boarded a special train, which was soon packed to overflowing, first by Garibaldi, his staff, and personal friends, and then by a score of the so-called National Guard of Salerno, and anyone else who could wedge himself through a door or climb onto a carriage roof. During the journey, the liberator was calm and quietly radiant. So was that other fine soldier, Cosenz, who smiled behind his spectacles at the thought that he would in a few hours see his mother, from whom he had been separated by 12 years of exile. The rest of the company in the train, which included Palmerston's secretary in his red shirt, W. G. Clark, the public orator of Cambridge University, Captain Forbes, R.N., and Edwin James, Q.C., were for the most part in boisterous and noisy spirits. The Italians kept singing over and over again, "Siamo Italiani, Giovanni Fresci, contro i tedeschi, vogliamo pugnare, viva l'Italia, viva l'Unione, viva Garibaldi e la Libertà." At Nocera, the enemy's Bavarians, in train for Capua, were shunted to let the victors pass. A little before they reached Pompeii, Garibaldi, who sat by the window on the side towards the mountain, said, "Look out, we shall soon see Vesuvius." When its cone and streamer hove in sight, Cosenz was visibly moved by the familiar form of the mountains of his boyhood. It was a day of scorching southern sun. Beyond Pompeii, the train made slow progress for even an express south of Naples, for between Torre Annunziata and Portici, the line was occupied by tens of thousands of the inhabitants of that densely populated coast. Fishermen who left their nets on the beach, swarthy fellows naked to the waist, who had been winnowing corn on the flat roofs of the houses, priests and monks leading their flocks, men, women and children in countless multitudes, rushed shouting onto the line and swayed to and fro round the train in their attempts to see and touch Garibaldi. In his carriage, the mayor of Naples and the staff officers were arranging the route which was to be taken in the streets of the capital. It was decided to go by the center of town and not by the quayside, lest they should needlessly provoke the Bourbon garrison by dragging the triumphal procession under the muzzles of the cannon at the Carmine and Castel Nuovo. Beyond Portici, the train was stopped by a naval officer who forced his way into the carriage in a state of frenzy, crying out to the dictator, "Where are you going to? The Bourbon troops have trained their cannon on the station of Naples." Garibaldi replied unmoved, "Bother the cannon. When the people are receiving us like this, there are no cannon," and ordered the train to proceed. As they went forward again, the commandant of the National Guard questioned the young officer, and it soon appeared that he was referring only to the cannon in the Carmine Castle close to the station, a danger which they had already taken into account. In 1860 there were only two short railways in the whole Neapolitan kingdom, connecting Capua and Vietri, respectively, with the capital. At that time both these lines terminated in a small junction some few hundred yards nearer to the sea than the present central station of Naples. On the morning of September 7th, the timid silence of the streets was broken by Count Ricciardi, who drove along the Toledo, standing up in his carriage with the Italian flag and shouting out to the citizens that they should assemble at the station to greet the dictator, who would arrive there at midday. But most men preferred to wait and see if Ricciardi's prophecy would be fulfilled before they committed themselves in face of the garrison, and it was a crowd of relatively moderate proportions that assembled at the appointed hour and place. Don Liborio, however, and the National Guard were there to represent the official world. An hour and a half passed by until, at 1:30, the train was seen to approach, and the Liberator stepped out onto the platform. As fast as the news that he had come spread through Naples, the whole city awoke as from sleep. Myriads seemed to spring out of the ground, and before Don Liborio had finished reading an address of welcome, to which no one even pretended to listen, an irresistible multitude stormed the station, swept aside every official barrier, swamped the lines of the National Guard, and took Garibaldi to itself. Don Liborio was whirled off on the flood and could not fight his way to the coveted seat in the dictator's carriage. Cosenz, who had an equally good right to be next to his chief, was borne down another eddy, but secured a horse and rode off to see his mother. A few minutes' fierce battling, Garibaldi found refuge in an open carriage, into which Bertani and a half a dozen of his old fighting companions managed to climb in after him. Such fine old heads with whitened beards and all their red shirts covered with purple stains, like English hunting coats which have been through sundry squire traps, as a lady wrote who watched the simple procession pass. At the back of the carriage clung a Neapolitan artist named Salazzaro, holding over their heads an enormous tricolor with the horse of Naples on one side and the lion of Venice on the other. In this fashion, without official escort or guard of any kind, did a son of the people, to use Garibaldi's own words, accompanied by a few of his friends who called themselves his aides-de-camp, enter the proud capital acclaimed by its 500,000 inhabitants, whose fierce and irresistible will paralyzed an entire army. According to the official plan, Garibaldi was to have entered Naples by the center of the city in order to avoid the forts, but outside the station, in what is now the Corso Garibaldi, the mob turned to the left instead of to the right, and in another minute they were passing under the muzzles of the loaded cannon of the Carmine. The soldiers were seen looking out at the carriage and its occupants, whom they could have blasted to pieces by moving a finger. Garibaldi stood up, folded his arms, and looked them straight in the face. Some of them saluted, and no one fired a shot. It is true that they were only acting in accordance with the specific orders of the king, but it is a matter of deep congratulation that no one in that unscrupulous and ill-disciplined force was tempted loyally to disobey. The mob had now reached the water's edge, and as the carriage turned to the right round the corner of the Carmine, its occupants were greeted by the most amazing sight and sound. For a mile long, the broad quayside was packed by as many of the 500,000 inhabitants of Naples as could find standing room, and all at first sight of Garibaldi broke out in one protracted yell of welcome. Along the north side of the quay, lined by tall commercial buildings, every window was astir with faces and waving arms fluttering handkerchiefs. On the other side, where lay the great port crowded with shipping of all nations, every mast was loaded with sailors shouting or singing songs of welcome in chorus. In middle distance, far overhead, the tyrant's castle of San Elmo looked down upon the scene. When the procession first left the station, Garibaldi had sat for the most part apparently unmoved, but from time to time he lifted his hat and smiled, as it were, with the eyes rather than the lips. But as they began to pass along the quay, he stood up, writes Sassio of the Thousand, who was with him in the carriage. His head was uncovered, and his face, in token of reverence, betrayed deep emotion. The carriage moved at a foot's pace on the long, open quay, and before it reached the shadow of Castel Nuovo, his bared features seemed to his companions in the carriage to have bronzed visibly under the scorching rays of the sun.
"Did you ever see such a triumph?" asked Bertani of Zasio. "No, not seen it," replied the veteran, "but I have often dreamt of it for the chief."
At length they reached the Castel Nuovo, sinister of aspect with its tall round towers of black tufa. Here again they might have been blown to pieces, but here again the enemy's sentinels saluted, and the guard turned out to do him honour. Thence he was carried along the side of the palace, also occupied by a Bourbon regiment. The forestieria, an annex of the palace used for the entertainment of court guests, was the goal of the procession. It stood on one side of the Largo San Francesco di Paola, an immense open space which was packed tight with spectators. From the windows of the forestieria, Garibaldi looked out sideways on the front of the palace a few yards off, with the enemy's soldiers in the gateway, and straight below him on the heads of the vast multitude, whom he addressed as follows:
"You have a right to exalt this day, which is the beginning of a new epoch, not only for you, but for all Italy, of which Naples forms the fairest portion. It is indeed a glorious day, and holy, that on which a people passes from the yoke of servitude to the rank of a free nation. I thank you for this welcome, not only for myself, but in the name of all Italy, which your aid will render free and united."
His speech showed clearly that it was of the union of Italy that he was thinking, as much as of the liberation of Naples. From the forestieria he was taken to the cathedral, where he was again almost smothered by the embraces of men and women. His fighting friar, Sicilian Pantaleo, conducted the service, and the terrified canon showed him the relics of St. Januarius, on the virtues of which he maintained a judicious silence. Thence he was taken to the Palazzo di Agri, now chosen as his permanent headquarters. It is a fine private mansion, standing conspicuously halfway up the mile-long Toledo at the debouchement of another important street, so that its balconies looked down both thoroughfares. The people filled in endless procession up and down the two streets, while Garibaldi showed himself to them on one of the highest balconies of the tall palace. the inhabitants of Naples were now in full delirium, gyrating through the streets like the dance of all the devils on the witches' Sabbath. True joy at liberation from tyranny moved the greater part of them. The feverish desire for the excitement of an unexampled festa drove on the rest, many of whom who had been Bourbonists a few months before, and would be Bourbonists again if the king returned. Men and women waved swords which they would never wield in earnest, and brandished daggers which they were more accustomed to employ. As the night wore on, the various cries of Viva Garibaldo, Galibar, Galibord, were finally shortened into Viva Board. When the voice gave out, a single finger was held up in token of the Union of Italy. Even after the first rage was spent, the Saturnalia continued intermittently for 3 days and nights in the thousand noisome valleys which composed the Naples of that era. But in the Toledo, while the crowd on the first evening was shouting under the Palazzo d'Agri for the dictator to reappear, a red shirt stepped out on the balcony and laid his cheek on his hand in token that his chief was sleeping. Egli dorme, whispered the vast multitude and dispersed in silence. During the rest of that night's carnival, the center of the city was left as noiseless and deserted as the streets of Pompeii. End of chapter 8.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.